This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
If someone had asked you 10 or 20 years ago about your hopes and dreams for your life, would it match up to where you are now? For many of us, life just doesn't go to plan. But what if those disappointments and setbacks turned out to be just as important in shaping our character and who we are as our successes? What if who we become actually means more to God than what we achieve? That's one of the ideas behind Sheridan Voice's latest book, The Making of Us, Who We Can Become When Life Doesn't Go As Planned. And Sheridan is with us from his home in Oxford. Good morning to you, Sheridan.
Morning, Katrina. Good to talk to you. And you know what? We've even got a little bit of sunshine out this morning, so miracles do happen.
Wow. It's very exciting for me now that I've actually been to your home to talk to you and be able to actually picture where you are. So, yeah, it's really nice.
I'm sitting in the little study upstairs, which you saw, and so I'm surrounded by all my books, my lovely library, and a nice big picture of a tree on the wall, which kind of inspires me to think about growth and new horizons and things. And talking to you, so gosh, you know, could the day be any better than this?
I am a bit jealous of your study, Sheridan. You know, as a writer, I think having a study like that is a bit of a dream, really.
Did I ever tell you about the sloping floor, though?
No.
Because the floor, because, you know, it's a 130-year-old house, which, you know, sounds very romantic to our Australian ears, but actually here, that's just really typical. So it's just a 130-year-old terrace house, and it actually means that everything slopes and everything's leaning, and including the floor. And so the floor is on a very slight angle. And so recently I've been getting kind of pain in my hips and my legs because I've been sitting on a slight angle for the last 7 years. So, you know, it's lovely, but yes, there are some downsides too. So don't feel too jealous.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about the new book, The Making of Us, which I assume you wrote in that very slopey study. What inspired you to write this book?
Well, a couple of things. Number one was the move to the UK in the first place. And maybe one or two of our kind listeners may have read a previous book of mine called Resurrection Year, which really tells that story. 10 years of trying to start a family, not being able to. Then we moved over here for my wife, Meryn, to get a job at Oxford University, which was a great gig to get for her. But it meant when I come over here, a whole bunch of doors that had been open to me in Australia were closed, or at least closed for a period of time. And I didn't know kind of the two classic human questions that we ask. Who are you? What are you doing here? We could otherwise say it's about identity and purpose. And for the first time in 15, 20-odd years, I didn't know the answer to those questions. I didn't know who I was, and I didn't know what I was doing on this earth anymore, because what I had been doing and who I had been didn't seem to work anymore. It didn't seem to be open to me anymore. Writing, speaking, broadcasting, those things that I'd built my life on, wasn't really happening over here. Publishers were turning me down, saying I should come back to them when I was famous. The BBC weren't returning my phone calls back then. Nobody was asking me to speak at their conferences. So who are you, Sheridan, and what are you to do now? So that was the two questions that were going around my mind. And then Resurrection Year came out in early 2013. By the end of that year, I had several hundred emails from readers saying almost exactly the same thing, that book had resonated with their broken dream. Now, it wasn't just infertility. It might be divorce, or maybe never getting married, or never getting the dream career, or having the dream career and losing it, something like that. Mm. And they were kind of saying the same thing. I'm now asking myself, who am I and what am I doing here? And so I thought, okay, I've got some questions, they've got some questions, let's go on a little journey and seek some answers.
Mm. I mean, I think what's quite interesting, you set this book around what I thought was a fairly obscure pilgrimage, you know, along the coast of northern England, tracing the influence of this ancient monk known as Cuthbert. Can you tell us what it was about Cuthbert that captured your, I guess, admiration?
Oh, great question, because I'm hoping that by the end of our few minutes together, Katrina, I will have converted everybody to love Cuthbert. He is this amazing, amazing guy. So Christianity came to what we now know as the United Kingdom, you know, Britain, probably in the 3rd or 4th century with the Romans, but it remained a Roman religion. So when they scuttled off back a couple of centuries later with their tail between their legs, you know, what of the faith really just died out with them, because it had never really penetrated the British heart. It was people like Hilda and Bede and Aidan and particularly Cuthbert that God used to really win the British heart. And this guy was an amazing, amazing person. He was a man of miracle. So, you know, God was using him supernaturally to do all sorts of healings and wonderful things like that. He loved the Bible. The book of John was his favorite book. And he had a mentor named Boisil, who they spent their last kind of 4 weeks of Boisil's life together studying the book of John. So that's a really key, important thing with him. He was a man of compassion and social action. He also, would you believe this, he actually is the creator of the world's very first conservation laws. So when we think about conservation and the environment, it actually ultimately starts with Cuthbert. He used to kind of retreat to this little island off the north of England called Inner Farn, and he kind of founded a law that said the locals couldn't eat the eider ducks and the other birds of the island. And so he became the very first person to start conservation laws.
So he was really a bit of a trailblazer then of the faith in the UK. All right. In this book, you're doing this pilgrimage, and as you're doing the pilgrimage, you're thinking about your calling, your sense of purpose in life. Why is that so important to you, Sheridan? You know, it's obviously something you've given a lot of thought to. Why do you think that that matters so much, to have that sense of purpose and that sense of calling?
Yeah, it's a good question, Katrina, because sometimes I've wondered whether I've thought about it too much. At the same time, I do think that everybody has that essential need to have a reason to get up in the morning. You know, we are not just people that are, you know, like puppy dogs, you know, are very happy just to, you know, wander around the house and eat our food and go for the occasional walk and, you know, sniff a few trees. You know, we actually have to have some sort of reason, some sort of purpose to get up in the morning. And for some people, that's their children. For others, it's their work. I would believe, actually, it incorporates all of those things plus more now. But I wondered whether I was too career-driven. And actually, I think part of the pilgrimage was actually coming to that realization that actually too much of my identity and purpose had been kind of focused on being a writer, speaker, broadcaster, you know. And then when that didn't open up over here for the first couple of years, then, well, who was I? And so I was really seeking for a bigger sense of self, a deeper sense of calling, something that is broader and bigger, something that incorporates not just the thing that you do for a job or a career, but actually incorporates every relationship that you have, that incorporates the whole universe, the world, you know, a much bigger sense of identity beyond just simply the job that I did.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that came out of that was friendship and the value of friendship. Which I really appreciated.
Very much.
Yeah.
Very much. That is one identity I think that we have really minimized in our culture. You know, we think about, you know, when we ask the question at a party, what do? Then we generally go to our job, and that's fine. Small talk has to begin somewhere. But how many of us would feel comfortable saying, I'm a friend? You know, it's not the identity we would want to kind of give because it doesn't seem prestigious, but I'm telling you, you look at all the research to do with mental health, to do with meaning in life, and I'll tell you what, if you can be a good friend to somebody else, that's a wonderful, holy, sacred calling.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the central premise that kind of comes out of this book seems to be that when our gifts are combined with our weaknesses or our struggles, that's when we can make a real difference in the world. So can you share with us some of the ways that you've seen that play out?
Yeah. This has been a real eye-opener for me, is to kind of look back at some of the great people that have really left a mark on the world, and you see this little formula, if you like, that kind of is at play, and it's that their talent is married to their trial. And their trial is married to their talent, and you bring those two together and you get some wonderful things happen. So I actually saw it first in the artists, great artists like Degas and Renoir and Matisse, and actually a lot of them, in Degas' situation, I think it was the last 50 years of his life, he suffered from retinal disease, and he actually got worse and worse with his eyesight as time went on. He had to move from paint to pastel because he could see the chalk lines of the pastel better than he could see brush strokes. But that resulted in some of his best masterworks, masterpieces, like the Blue Dancers. Matisse is a classic one. Towards the end of his life, he had had some operation for cancer that had left him wheelchair-bound. He then started working with collage, and that's where his great pieces like The Snail came out, some of his best work. And so something happened when the trial was married with the talent that they kind of brought out some wonderful masterpieces. Now, you think about some of the great Christian leaders that we've admired over the years. Think about Johnny Erickson Tada, has a diving accident, becomes quadriplegic from that. Prays for healing, goes to all sorts of very well-known faith healers, spends kind of a few years seeking to be miraculously healed from her condition, never is. And what happens? The wonderful thing that is birthed from that is Johnny and Friends, which is one of the largest organizations of its kind to help people with disabilities. Those kinds of things are amazing. Mm. And I had started to see that with the Resurrection Year book, that by combining, the situation that we'd gone through, which was 10 years of infertility, and then touching other people with broken dreams, but doing it through writing, that somehow we'd start to see a whole bunch of people find new hope and even faith again. And it was like, well, what's all about? That's so different to what I was doing previously. And it was this kind of combination of trial and talent. So it's a great thing for all of us, I think, to consider is the deepest trial that you go through, combined with your God-given talent, could actually be the very thing that God uses to bring your greatest contribution into the world.
Mm. That's quite an empowering thought for people who might have been having difficulty facing something, that they've been through and facing up to it and looking it in the eye, that, if you actually have the courage to do that, maybe something good can come out of it. Interestingly, Sharon, a lot of the examples you gave of those artists in particular, they suffered something very physical. And I thought it was quite interesting in your book, which is essentially, a spiritual or philosophical kind of story, that there was also this physical challenge that you were doing, and it was surprisingly sort of physically draining for you both. There were moments when you really struggled with the physical challenge of the walk. So what role did that physical challenge play in the spiritual journey?
Yeah, I'd love to say that the pain of the pilgrimage towards the end, opened up the heavens, and suddenly we were able to see like we'd never seen before into the spiritual realm. as the journey went on. So it was 116 miles. So in kilometres, isn't that terrible? Shows how much of a Brit I am now that I'm speaking in miles rather than kilometres. But I think it's about 230 kilometres or so. So, it's a fairly decent walk, mm-hmm. about 8 days that we took. And yes, we got more and more painful as time goes on, particularly for my friend DJ, who was walking along with me. He got really bad blisters. I got quite bad hip and pack pain, probably because my pack wasn't fitted properly. Actually, it just made it sometimes harder to hear from God during that time because you're just so exhausted. Mm. On the other hand, it can lead to some great discoveries. So I remember one afternoon, and we had toyed, do we take a shortcut? Do we actually take a taxi for the last 16 k's or so of today's walk? And we just felt that that was copping out and giving up. And then finally we decided, let's do it, because it'll help us to continue the journey in the long run. It'll help us walk again tomorrow. So we did that. I'm lying in the little motel that we're in the afternoon and just kind of thinking, oh, I feel so tired and I feel very painful. I miss all that wonderful sense of closeness to God that I had at the beginning. And in The Making of Us, the first chapter of The Making of Us, there's this, quite special for me encounter with God before I'd even begun the pilgrimage. And all that's gone. And yet out of that came a great lesson about rest, about the need to actually give ourselves permission to rest when we need to rest. And I haven't been so good at doing that. In fact, I would look back at my life and see probably about 3 mini burnout seasons, and they've all come from me feeling that I should be somebody else, that I should be stronger, better, more spiritual, more successful, as good as the other people that I'm looking at and I'm being inspired by. And so those difficult times can actually be, for me anyway, they've turned out to be a great revelator of the role of comparison in my heart, and how I had to get rid of that sense of comparison, always comparing myself to others, because it's only destructive in the end.
I have to say that was one of the strongest lessons that I took out of the book, was that value of rest and how we actually even need to plan for seasons of rest. And is it something that you have been able to practice since you did this walk? Like, are you continuing, has that stayed with you, that?
Yes, you're not putting me on the spot to see whether I'm actually living out what I've learned. Mm. Well, that sense of retreat, yes, I have. So I actually try to do it in a number of ways. Number one, I try to have it every day. So I can't start the day now without having at least 15 minutes. Often it's longer, but then again, I'm in a position where I can because I work for myself. I don't have kids, and I know some of our listeners won't have this freedom. But, you know, at least 15 minutes, if not longer, of just what I call dwelling time with God, just being present before God. That's quiet. That's in solitude. That's in silence. It is prayer, but it's as much kind of listening as it is asking and talking. I can't start the day without that now. So that's my little kind of retreat time. I try to put another little retreat in the midst of the day, late for kind of mid-afternoon if I can. At a broader level, I've been a little bit nicer to myself in terms of giving myself weekends off. And I do also try to schedule in a retreat, like a one-day retreat, every quarter. Now, I haven't been successful at doing that yet, but putting in more of a kind of a one-day retreat plan in place, which you can actually do. Some people say, oh, I can't do that. I've got kids and everything. There are ways to make it work. You can come up with arrangements with your husband, your wife, that they take the kids for that day. You then repay them with looking after the kids on another day when they can do a retreat. I know a family that are doing that just now. Mm. So there is ways to do it, and I really would encourage you to do it because it can be just so refreshing.
Mm. All right. One of the beautiful moments in the book, and I hope this isn't a spoiler, Sheridan, was the moment of serendipity that you experienced when you arrived at Durham Cathedral. Mm-hmm. Are you happy to share that moment?
Yes, yeah, that's fine. So the pilgrimage was from Lindisfarne Island, and it was then kind of walking south down to Durham. Cuthbert was kind of based on Lindisfarne, and then later on his monks carried his body when they were kind of fleeing the Vikings, and then finally, 100 years later, they basically rested in Durham, and now Durham Cathedral was built around his shrine. The whole city of Durham has been built around Cuthbert's life, if you like, so it's a good place to end. We got there, and here we were. We were trying to make the 3:15 evensong service in Durham Cathedral, and we thought that would be just be a good marker point. Anyway, as the day has gone on, we're both in pain. Poor old DJ's now, both feet are completely covered in blisters. So we're kind of running. We're trying to get there in time. We get there about 20 minutes late, and as we walk in, the place is packed. And we're thinking, well, what's going on? When did evensong services at cathedrals become so popular? And we couldn't find a seat. And finally, we were able to perch ourselves up against the base of one of the giant stone columns that holds that beautiful cathedral up. And I'm facing towards the front, but I can't see anything that's happening at the front of the church. And DJ is facing on an opposite column, facing back towards the back of the church, kind of looking at me. And after a while, we then hear this visiting speaker get up, and he starts saying these words. He says, some of you this week have been on a pilgrimage. that's interesting. Some of you this week have been retracing the steps of Cuthbert and Bede and Hilda and Aidan. Whoa, that's us. Some of you this week have been, and he started rattling all these things off that had been just exactly what we'd been going through. And it's just like, what is going on? Have all these people come to welcome us into Durham? It wasn't so romantic as that. It turned out that we had stumbled into the one and only service dedicated to pilgrimage for Durham Cathedral, the one and only one. They'd never run it before, never have run it again. We just happened to arrive on that very service. And it was just this beautiful moment of serendipity, a kind of a moment where you think about providence, that maybe all the threads of our lives, all the details, all the ups and downs and the twists and turns and all the dark moments and all the bright, shiny moments, actually in the heart of God, in the plan of God, somehow all thread together to make us who we are. They can all be part of the making of us.
Mm. And what are your thoughts now on the value of undertaking a pilgrimage?
I love the idea. I haven't been on another one as long as that, but I really hunger to do one. So you've got to plan. So to get ready for a decent pilgrimage like that, you have to spend several months actually doing kind of graduating your walks longer and longer as you're preparing. You've got to prepare your feet. You've got to prepare your heart and your soul. You've got to prepare your stamina, your energy. So several months in preparation. But what I have done is I've done some one-day pilgrimages. So this is something that, you know, all of us can put into place if you want to. Think of a place that you'd like to get to. Plan maybe to, say, walk about 15K or something like that. So if that's 15K from your house, that's great. Living here in Oxford, there's a number of really good places that I can walk to from there. Mm. If that's not so the case for you, maybe take some public transport to 15Ks out of where you want to go to. I started with some psalms, started reading some scripture. I start kind of placing the whole day before God as something special, something set apart and different. And then walk with God. Just walk with God and have that as a prayer time. You'll find that your senses become open to the wonderful sounds that you're hearing around you, the birds and the sights that you're seeing, with even something as simple as a swaying tree can become quite beautiful. And you start to see the presence of God in everything, or at least around everything. And then arrive at your destination and take a journal and journal some of the things that are coming up. What are the themes that are coming up in as you pray or think? Journal all those down. And it's just something worth trying. We've got Bible study. We've got prayer. Some of us have been on a retreat. Try a little one-day pilgrimage and see how you go.
Hmm. Before we let you go, have you got some thoughts you could share with us just on how people have been responding to the book? What kind of feedback have you been getting?
It's been really quite moving. So there's at the end of the book, I include this thing called the Creed, which I know, Katrina, that you've read, and a lot of people have kind of found that.
I've actually
quite
shared
helpful.
It in this radio program as well, Sheridan. I've played the audio from your video. Mm.
I'm so grateful. That seems to have really resonated. So I'm hearing about that being read out and played on numerous radio stations around the world. I heard about a group of teachers, 150 teachers that were all given it recently as kind of a guide to their life and their work. A person that's working with missionaries, aid workers that are coming back from the field trying to recalibrate their life, they were given all a copy of that. So I've heard about the book being given to people who have just gone through drug overdoses to kind of get them refocused on their life. Heard about it being given to people who don't have any dramatic stories like that, but just are really wanting to find some refreshment. A neighbor of mine who isn't a Christian said she'd loved the story because she just wanted to read a book about a pilgrimage and about a journey from one place to another and everything you go through as you're doing that. So, it's only been out 8 weeks. It's still new, and but the feedback that's coming back is really lovely.
Hmm. Can you give us a bit of a sneak peek into what the next project will be? Have you got something in the back of your mind that you're chewing over?
I've always got two or three book projects in the back of my mind that I'm chewing over. But The Making of Us took, 4 years of reflection, another couple of years to write. So it was really quite a labor of love, and I was quite exhausted by the end of it. I feel like I put everything into that book. It feels like my most important book. I think I probably just need a bit of a rest before I start any major project. We're talking about some gift books, so some other little projects that'll probably slip in between. In the future, I would love to write a book about experiencing God, how you experience God in your everyday life. I've been working on that for a while. I'd love to write a book about love. I think we've really misunderstood love in our day and age. I'd love to write a book about that. There's lots of book ideas, but I think I just need a retreat, and I probably need just a little bit of rest and refreshment before I go on.
Well, I think after you've had some rest, Sheridan, maybe you could write a book about rest.
Yeah,
exactly. It's very much needed in our culture, I think. All right.
I think so.
Well, lovely to talk to you. Thanks for sharing your journey with us.
Yeah, thanks, Katrina. Always good talking.
That is Sheridan Voysey, and we've been talking about his latest book, The Making of Us, Who We Can Become When Life Doesn't Go As Planned. You can find out more at his website, themakingofus.com.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with life words. Subscribe to Hope 1032's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.